Welcome to Cider Chat. In this episode, we're speaking to award-winning cider maker Christine Walter of Baumann Cider, based in Oregon. Hello, my name is Rhea Windcaller, and I am the producer and cider MC of this weekly podcast, where we speak with makers, cider enthusiasts, and folks within the cider trade from around the world. Are you new to cider? Is this kind of like your first little tap into the world and trying to understand more? Well, if so, you've totally come to the right place because we're all about everything to do with cider. We cover the globe, meeting incredible makers, hearing their backstory, learning about their own production. Folks are sharing tips and helping us delve into this very old tradition of fermenting fruits into a delectable libation and sorting through it as we come to a more modern era to make our own present day mark on it. So it's a cool place to be, and I'm super stoked that you have joined all of us. I am the host, as I mentioned, Rhea Windcaller. From time to time, you might hear my friends, the Talking Palms. We have Mr. Quince.
Hello.
And the Medlars.
Hello.
And Perry Pear.
Yes, I am Perry Pear. Nice to meet you.
Perry, you don't quite sound like yourself. Your voice is a little off. What's up?
Too much fun, Rhea.
Oh, I know what that is. I mean, it was last weekend. It was our annual Cider Days. And though it was different this year, and there's some changes coming down the pike, we had a wonderful cider share here at Cider Chat Central, didn't we?
Indeed, Rhea. Indeed.
Yeah, it was a late night. And Perry, I did notice you, like, when I was kind of putting everything away once all our guests left, you were still out by the fire checking out some of the ciders and Perry's, I suspect, right?
Wonderful, Rhea. Absolutely wonderful.
Good, my friend. I love it. I love it. And Mr. Quince, you saw that Steve Seeland of South Hill Cider was here, and he brought a bottle of his Quince cider. In fact, those were the Quince that had arrived at his cidery when I was recording there in 2018, and still haven't tasted. I'm really excited to do that. We also had a couple other guests, the folks from Ragged Hill, Steve and Ann. That's a father and daughter team. Incredible cider, Pomo, ice cider. It's going to blow your socks off. We also had Elizabeth Ryan of Hudson Valley Farmhouse Cider. A really nice scene, one of the highlights this year for me. And I suspect you too, Perry Pear.
Perry has nodded off.
Oh my goodness, Mr. Quince. You mean the poor little Perry Pear has already fallen asleep almost like mid-sentence?
He's tired.
Yeah, Medlars, I could see that. Oh, well, you know, that's what happens when you're having a good time and you just don't want to miss a moment. And I could so relate to that. Look, we're going to come back and we're going to hear a snippet from season 3. This is with Tom Oliver of Oliver's Cider and Perry Company out in Herefordshire. This was recorded at Cider Days in 2017. And in this piece here, Tom is talking about a person by the name of Roger French and how he really informed Tom back in the day. So let's roll to that next. That's episode 105.
He lives in a cottage in Checkley. It's a small cider maker's cottage. And if you can imagine, there's a kitchen which he dug a cellar out underneath by hand to store his cider and perry in. And it fills with water. So you can't have any electric down there. You have to go down with a torch and you retrieve bottles that are sort of moldy and fungus-ridden. And one day he went down and he retrieved a bottle and it looked ghastly. You know, it looked like my early types of attempt at making cider and perry. And he prized the top off and offered me a glass. And it was glorious. It was aromatic. It was sparkling, but in a beautiful sort of sensory way. Lots of small bubbles. It was a phenomenal experience on the nose, and the taste was ballistic experience. It was a Kingston Black cider, and right at that moment, I knew that this was the style of drink that I wanted to make.
I think this little interview with Tom Oliver, especially this little clip, shows us how we are all served by someone before us, someone who was a role model, someone we looked up to, someone's product that we tasted and just rocked our world and led us down this rabbit hole into cider. And for Tom Oliver, that one person, and I'm sure there was more, but one he's speaking of here was Roger French, who, by the way, wrote a book called The History and Virtues of Cider. I think that came out in 1983. Next, we're going to roll to a clip with Chad Cook of Cider Hill. Cider Hill is based in Massachusetts, up by the coast. And here he's talking about making ice cider. He won a big award for his ice cider, and he was really kind in sharing a whole bevy of tips on how to work with ice cider, which can be a little bit persnickety. It doesn't always stop fermentation in the same way that a cider does. And so these were some of the things that he looks at. So we're going to roll to that clip now with Chad Cook.
The guys up in Quebec that do not use sulfites, I'm pretty sure that they just leave it frozen or refrigerated at the end of fermentation up to 9 months just to kill off any yeast that are in there. We only leave it cold for a couple weeks, and we do use sulfites to stabilize our cider. And we sterile filter. And we actually add sorbate as well. But below the recommended dose and below the flavor threshold. But, you know, sorbate effectiveness is to some extent pH dependent, but based on the alcohol content. And with an ice cider, where ours is 12.5%, we can get away with using something below the sensory threshold. And you do have to watch sorbates in particular. Over about 6 months, they'll start to break down and taste like celery.
Yeah.
They're weird. And
yeah, people really try to avoid sorbate for that.
Yeah, we made a batch of ice cider a few years ago and used sorbate in it, and even today we cannot taste the sorbate. If you use little enough, unless you are an expertly trained palate, which I hate to say this for our customers, but they are not, they're not going to taste it, even in 4 years. So the ice cider will continue to age and improve despite that.
Now, my new Ciderville, that was back in 2016 when I recorded with Chad Cook. A lot has changed since then. That's 5 years ago, and I do see the palate of cider drinkers definitely increasing. The education is there. So what may not have been detected before might get detected now. I don't know. But it's kind of cool to have this like archive look into the world back in 2016 and what folks are talking about. Really informative. I hope you're enjoying it as much as I am. This is episode 296 of Cider Chat. So we are essentially three episodes away from episode 300, which is always a celebration. And got a special treat rolling out for that episode for all of you. A new song coming out, which I enjoyed writing, singing along with my cousin Jay, and thinking of all you folks out there worldwide in Ciderville as I was writing it. So it's a little tongue-in-cheek, as always, and should be fun. So stay tuned for that. All right, another little break here. We'll be right back with a word about our sponsor, the Northwest Cider Club.
Walking through the orchards.
Receiving a box of cider at your doorstep is one of those moments in the day that can really make your month. You know, it can like change your whole attitude and know that there's goodness in the world again. And the Northwest Cider Club makes that really easy. They are featuring cider makers in their territory because this club is under the umbrella of the Northwest Cider Association. All good people really helping to promote cider and helping you to be able to get a taste of the Pacific Northwest. Now, the end of the year cider box this year is called Big Sky. And so I'm on the website right now. I went to nwciderclub.com/podcast. And up on the top, it says join, explore, connect, gift, right? Remember? Good gift giving time. They make it really easy. You just kind of scroll down and you'll see you'll have all these different choices. You could get the Elevated Cider Club, the Discover Cider Club. And guess what? In the box this season for Big Sky, not only are they featuring ciders from Idaho and Montana, but they have one cider from our featured guest, on this here episode from Oregon, who is using Montana apples, specifically Macintosh. We've been talking about Macintosh apples with all the makers who I've had on the podcast this past couple of weeks here. So you're going to get to hear in a little bit when I roll out the featured conversation with Christine Walter why she chose to import Montana apples to Oregon to ferment. Just so cool. I just love that. You know, cider makers who think out of the box, they see a good thing when they know it and they go for it. And that's exactly what Christine's all about, and certainly the Northwest Cider Association and all their members. So check it out. Go to nwciderclub.com/podcast and sign up for your box today, because the window is going to be closing at the end of this month for this particular cider box. Don't get scared. Just become proactive. Put the podcast on pause right now and go to nwciderclub.com/podcast. We also have another sponsor this week, and that is the American Cider Association, who is also actually a patron of this here podcast via the Cider Chat Patreon page. The American Cider Association is inviting you to the 12th Annual CiderCon, which is a global cider conference for cider professionals. CiderCon is taking place February 1st through the 4th, 2022, in beautiful Richmond, Virginia, at the heart of a celebrated cider region. With tours, tastings, educational workshops, demos, and more, CiderCon's return to an in-person event is bound to be one of the most energetic CiderCons to date. Special highlights this year include some amazing tours thanks to the support of the Virginia Association of Cider Makers and the Virginia Wine Marketing Office. CiderCon 2022 will host the first ever overnight tour of the Northern Shenandoah Valley. The Shenandoah Valley is nestled between the Blue Ridge and Allegheny Mountains and is the heart of historic Virginia apple country. The tour will highlight some of the valley's orchards and discussions on growing apples and cider production techniques in the valley. CiderCon 2022 will also feature a tour of Richmond's Jackson Ward. Once known as Black Wall Street for the many financial services, cultural icons, and entrepreneurs who made the neighborhood thrive, Jackson Ward is an indelible part of Richmond's tapestry. This guided bus and walking tour will feature history, food, and, of course, cider. Tickets to CiderCon are just $435 if you book by January 20th. To learn more about the wide array of events and educational sessions being offered and to register for CiderCon, go to ciderassociation.org today. CiderCon is an ACA member event produced with generous support of their members and the ACA's premier sponsor, FruitSmart. Up next is our featured conversation with Christine Walter of Bauman Cider. She's going to be taking us first to the place that really was the catalyst for her getting into cider to begin with, gave her that aha moment. Then we'll hear a bit about the farm itself. It's a long-running family farm dating back to 1895 in Oregon, now considered a destination for so many value-added products. They have events year-round and now also cider. She is kicking out some amazing stuff, an award-winning cider maker, and an absolutely lovely person, too. Actually, on this past weekend at the Cider Share at my home, Chris Kazix from Oregon, while he's actually interning with Christine right now, came out and he brought a cider by the name of Mountain Rose that just knocked everybody's socks off. It was absolutely delicious. So these single varietal ciders are coming out. And something that she really loves to do. And she also has a number of fruit ciders. She'll be talking at length about the Loganberry. And I'll tell you, by the end of that, I was hankering for a Loganberry cider from Bauman's. So let's check it out. Let's all now grab a glass and join this chat with Christine Walter of Bauman's Cider in Oregon.
I grew up on an apple farm, so I've always been around apples and we pressed apple juice every fall as a family. And then eventually my family started a fruit stand, and so they would press juice for the fruit stand. And then one year I was on a fishing trip with my dad in Alaska, and we went to go pick up some refreshments, and they had a very slim beer selection. And so I decided to buy some hard cider, and it was a 6-pack of Angry Orchard Crisp Apple. And it was the first time I'd ever had hard cider. And I drank it and had this like epiphany and said, we could do this. Like, this is just fermented apples. And so I came home from that fishing trip and I sat down with my cousins and I was like, you guys, you need to be fermenting our apple juice. What are you doing? And they said, oh yeah, yeah, great idea. And then, you know, a month or two later, I was like, why aren't you fermenting the apple juice? And they said, it's too hard. You know, we'll never get licensed. We're on a farm, all of these things. And I said, that's not true. People can do it. People have done it. And by then I was kind of starting to dig into it a little bit myself and to visit cideries on farms and investigate. And so as I did that, I just became more and more enamored with the industry. And I started to talk to cider makers and I fell in love with them. I mean, like these are nerdy people, of the kind of nerdy people that I like to be around. And so that was the beginning of it.
And what was the year there? Can you timestamp that first?
That would have been maybe 2014 when I first dabbled in it. And then 2015 was when I really started to, like, I took the Peter Mitchell class and I started, you know, investigating it from a professional level.
And then once you started dabbling into it, then all of a sudden at the farm, I imagine there had to be some space made available to bring in ferment. How did that go?
Okay. So I say to my family, hey, if I could just have a little corner of one little barn and I just, you know, just like 10 feet by 10 feet, that's all I'll need. and you know, I kind of taped it off on the floor so that I could get that space licensed by the TTB. Mm-hmm. And so that was my corner. And that lasted about maybe a couple months. And then of course I started to expand and move my tape bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. And then, and in terms of volume, like, we were pressing about 50,000 gallons a year of fresh cider that we were selling in gallon jugs out the front of the house, you know, like, just fresh juice. And so I don't remember that first year, I probably only maybe made 3,000 gallons. And then the next year I probably took 10,000 gallons of our juice. Year three, I took 50,000, which meant we had to buy apples from other orchardists around and other farmers and, you know, get juice pressed by other people. So, and along with that, my tape just got bigger and bigger. And I then was like, maybe I'll just take over this whole little shed. And they, so it went like that. And they love to remind me that right now I'm in a space that's probably, maybe 3,000 square feet versus the first 100 square feet that I had promised that I needed. And of course, I look around and I say, I have no room for anything. I can't store any empty bottles now. I can't store full bottles. So that's been the physical progression of my cider on the farm.
My goodness, that's kind of hilarious, but also predictable too, isn't it?
I know, absolutely. And I think it shocked them how popular it became. You know, in the beginning, it was like we had, gosh, I can't even remember. We only did draft for the longest time, so we didn't even bottle, and we did that with kind of the intent that we would have a little growler station in the front of the fruit stand, you know, where people could come and buy a pint or buy a growler. And it was probably 2.5 years in before I started bottling anything. And so we sold the bulk of our product from right here on the farm, which was lovely. I mean, I know that a lot of farm-based cideries on the East Coast do that same sort of thing. And I think that's wonderful because then you get to see it, right? You get to see, well, there's the orchard and here's the cider.
Right. And the farm itself is kind of like a full-service farm, isn't it? And you're having events there?
It is a full-service farm. You know, when I was a kid, it was really it was a lot of acreage, but the acreage spread between many, many, many crops, you know, berries and apples and nuts and pears and peaches and all of that. And then we, and of course seed crops and plenty of grains for feeding the animals. And so when people would come to the farm to buy a bushel of apples, you know, we just had like a little homemade cooler out there and people would drive up and honk their horn and get a bushel of apples or a crate of berries. And then a lot of what we picked, we would take to Fresh Market or to the cannery, you know, the in town, the cannery, right, and sell it like that or sell it to the stores. But then my aunt and uncle, when they got married, which is 40 and a couple years ago, she wanted to stay home when she started having kids. And so they put out a little, you know, stand out in front of their house, which is on a little bit more like occupied highway than the farm, which is off down a mile long gravel road. And so that kind of exposure meant that they could have more and more and more available for Fresh Market. And that's what they did. And then as her kids got older and went to school, then my cousins, they would host the pumpkin patch for the class, you know? Mm-hmm. And so then that became kind of an annual event, the pumpkin patch and the Easter egg hunt. And then, you know, like the Christmas tree cutting. And so all of these things kind of arose on the family farm out of just a need to, like, you know, satisfy this little place in the community where people could come and bring their kids and do the farm stand things. And then it's gotten bigger and bigger and bigger. And I would say every year it is a bigger event, except the last 2 years, it's not been quite as big as usual, but that's great. And now it's really quite a monstrosity and people come here and they're like, oh my God, I thought this was a little farm. It's not a little farm. It's a massive farm. And during Harvest Festival, we employ over 100 people. Wow. Here on the farm, and not even the harvest crew. That's the front of house crew.
Oh my goodness. Wow. So can you give us a little bit of a picture then of the farm? You said it's up a mile, gravel road up a mile.
So the original homestead, my grandparents' homestead, is several hundred acres, and it was my great, great grandmother's homestead. She and her two boys, Stephen and Leo, they came out here from Minnesota in 1895. They were originally from, not Germany, but Austro-Hungary.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And so they homesteaded here. And then when my, and that means planting the orchard and building the house and clearing some land and getting some animals. And so they did all that. And then that land passed to great grandpa Stephen when he got married, and he farmed. And then my grandpa Clyde was his youngest son. And he then took over farming operations when he married my grandma Margaret, and they lived there my entire life. They lived there my grandpa's entire life. He was born in the house and died in the house 91 years later.
Wow.
Never lived in another place.
Oh my god.
Isn't that amazing?
It is.
So that's the farm. And so it's this idyllic setting, you know, the classic like oak trees and surrounded by a river on three sides. It's the Pudding River down here. And it's lovely, just the most wonderful. And we've got, you know, rolling acres of hazelnuts and peaches and apples and berries. And it's just
ideal.
An incredible place. Yeah.
Definitely.
It was a great place to grow up.
Yeah, it sounds like it. And were you always close by to the farm growing up or
yes.
on the farm?
Yeah. So my parents lived a couple miles away, but it meant that during the summers, my siblings, one or two of us, and a few cousins would stay all summer at Grandma and Grandpa's house to be there for harvest every day. You know, you start with the seed harvest in the spring, the onions and planting, you know, potatoes and onions and all of those kind of vegetables. And then training berries and hoeing in the fields. And then, of course, the berries and the apples start, and you start picking, you know, one crop after another. And so we would tend to stay there from Sunday night until Saturday night. And it would, because we would go home to like get cleaned up and do our laundry at our parents' house, and then go to church, and then come back. And on during the week, we would walk the gravel road where people would always park and toss their cans. And in Oregon, of course, we have a bottle bill. So we would take those cans to the grocery store on Saturday afternoon and trade them in for the money that we would need to go to the church bingo game on Saturday night. And it was such a, like, this rhythm of the most joy ever to, you know, like earn this money. You earn your berry picking dollars and your can collecting dollars. And then you take that money and you play bingo, and sometimes you hit it big. And it just was like such a childhood.
Yeah, you lived and are living that farming family experience that a lot of folks can't necessarily relate to, probably a generation or so back, but you're still living it today, which is really commendable that your family has kept it together and is continuing on that tradition. So
yeah, it's really lovely.
Moving forward now, you said about 3 years in, you were using about 50,000 gallons of cider. Where are you now with Baumann's? How's that?
Where are we now? Let's see. Of course, last year kind of skewed the numbers a little bit.
Yeah.
So I think that, let me do some quick math. We're probably close to 100,000 gallons a year.
My goodness. And what kind of press are you using? Are you using the same one this whole time? Or
yes, we are, but it's growing more and more uncomfortable. Let me tell you what this week has been like. Because of course, right now, all the apples are coming in. We're picking we picked through all the Gravensteins, and today they pressed the golden russets, and we got a couple French varieties from neighboring farms yesterday. Mm-hmm. And so we have a rack and cloth hydraulic press that we can press about 3,000 to 4,000 gallons a day, but it's pretty labor intensive. That's three or four people working a full 8 to 10 hour day.
Right.
And so it gets a little crazy, a little stressful. And we are so fortunate here in the Northwest. We have, there's a guy named Ryle. You probably know Ryle.
I do know Ryle. I've had him on the podcast. Yes.
Oh, you have. Yeah. Isn't he just the best?
Yeah.
Well, mobile pressing. And he just pulls right up with his truck and saves our lives. Saves our hides, because he can, you know, one man show kind of operate this press right out on our pad. And I don't know the volumes that he does, because with him and the way his press is set up, we typically will press all of our single varietal stuff with him. It just is easier the way his belt press is set up, that he can start a variety, end it, and then empty the hose and start a new, you know, with each one. Mm-hmm. Whereas with our stuff, one of the great benefits of our press is that we have a setup where we have a UV pasteurizer, and that allows us to make our fresh cider available without, you know, it needs to be refrigerated, but it's UV treated so that it kills the bacteria and we don't have to worry about E. coli and Listeria and all those things that fresh juice drinkers need to worry about.
Right.
So we end up pressing for a lot of local farmers, you know, like smaller farm stands, smaller farmers that just want to be able to offer their apple juice to their customers. And people come from as far away as the coast and bring their apples and then wait for us to press it and run it through the UV pasteurizer. And that has been, I mean, it both creates a lot of craziness and extra you know, to and fro on the farm, and trucks coming in and unloading bins of apples all day, every day, and doing that. But it's been a nice, you know, kind of a service, you mm-hmm, know, mm-hmm. to have that and to offer that to our neighbors. But anyway, so we use Ryle a lot, and that's really helpful, especially in September and October when we're just in the thick of it.
Yeah. You're in it now for sure.
We are in it.
So you're making the cider, and you have these adorable bottles that always have like a little, like, it probably has a name for the paper that goes over the bottle cap.
Oh, like a tamper seal.
A tamper seal. Yes. Okay, there we go. That's the name of it. And I know that you had it would be your great-grandfather, Stephen?
My great-grandpa, Stephen, on there, yep.
On the label, you know, looking like a good farmer would. And that's kind of your mainstay label. So I'm wondering,
yes.
And knowing a bit about Oregon, which is an amazing fruit region of all different kinds of varieties of fruit, and I see that you have a number of different fruit ciders. Do you have a particular flagship cider for folks to...
Sure do. Our Loganberry cider has been wildly popular since the moment we made it, and we grow the Loganberries, and we are, I suspect, the largest Loganberry producer possibly in the U.S. because we sell to, like, especially before I started making cider, we sold to people all over. We would ship frozen drums of Loganberries to the East Coast, to New York, to the South. Like, a lot of people make a Loganberry wine, I believe.
Can you explain what a Loganberry is like for folks who don't have it in their region?
It is the quintessential berry flavor. It is so, like, it's a cross between a raspberry and a blackberry. The blackberry that it crosses is like a boysen. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you get all these very incestuous berry relationships when you look at the the hybridization charts, but it's very sordid and dark. Mm-hmm. No, but this berry is just, it's lively like a boysen, and yet it has this like crazy acid like raspberries, and it just is so much like a Jolly Rancher berry flavored, and I love it. I love the flavor. I love the smell. And, you know, growing up picking Loganberries, Logans are one of the first caneberries, possibly the first. It depends on which kind of raspberries you have. Sometimes the Goldens will come on earlier than the Logans. But for caneberries, Logans are the first ones that we had on the farm. Mm-hmm. And so it had this, like, this excitement, you know, when the Logans were ripe, and you would go walk through the berry field and pick off the ripest ones and eat them before you ever even had a strawberry for the mm-hmm. season. Mm-hmm. So it holds this excitement and mystique, and they are also coincidentally a super soft berry. So when you threw them at your cousins, like, it made a mess. I went to bed many a night with Logan seeds still at my scalp.
Oh, you wild child, you. Oh, my goodness. Something you never
I was
changed.
The worst of them. Yeah, exactly. So that is definitely our flagship cider. We took a best in show at Glint Cap. I think the first year I ever bottled Logan, I entered it into Glint Cap, and we won that. And so that was amazing and affirming, because it's such a, like, amazing flavor. And mm-hmm. so when we make that cider, it is apple juice that we ferment to almost dry. And then we, just at the end of fermentation, we put whole Loganberries that we puree with an immersion blender. We puree up the berries and we throw them right in the tank with the cider, and we pump it over for a couple days, and then back sweeten with a little fresh apple juice. And that is all. There is nothing else in that cider. It is Logans and apples.
And what is the color of that particular cider?
And it's bright red.
Bright red. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just lovely.
Yeah. That's cool that you puree it up. Why do you do that?
So Logan plums are not as forthcoming with their color as a blackberry. And, you know, they're the color of a raspberry, and that's a tough color to get to come through. So we really have to do some sweet talking to the Logans, and I mean, maybe not even sweet talking, like we're just like fists in and right and in. Give it no alternative but to give up that color and flavor. So that's that's why the pump over. We just want as much contact with the those little berries as possible. And so the pureeing, like otherwise you could probably sit the berries in there for a few days and they really wouldn't have given up much color.
Got it. Yeah. Okay. That makes sense. So the Loganberry's the flagship, and then there's other fruit ciders, and then you also do small batch ciders too. Is that right?
Yeah. So we grow, maybe close to 20 different varieties of caneberries here. And so I have tried a cider with almost every one of those caneberries to pick my favorites. And we do one. One year we were afraid that we were going to run out of Loganberries because it was a pretty light Loganberry year. And we couldn't not have our flagship berry cider. And so we tried to distract people by making another berry cider that was that we put equal gusto into. And it's called All the Berries. And then in parentheses, in my head, it says, except for Loganberry, because we really just wanted to like do a little shell game with people and be like, well, I know you like Bauman's Loganberry, but have you thought of all the other berries? And so it's a berry bomb. We use our Marionberries and our blueberries and our raspberries. And sometimes we'll throw in boysens or kind of whatever we have, whatever our artistic flair is of the day when we're pulling our frozen buckets of berries out of our freezer, then we put in those berries into all the berries. And then we also do a boysenberry lemonade where we use like fresh zested lemons and lemon juice. And then our boysenberries, and that one I love. It tastes like summer. It's just like that kind of lemony tangy flavor. And, a very popular choice among brides, like on a hot summer day, they envision like hot sun and, and boysenberry lemonade and, you know, happily ever after. Just goes hand in hand. So, we also do a peach raspberry cause we grow the peaches and it's a great thing to do with all the peaches that are bruised or people squeeze too hard. And we just take them and, cut them up and put them in our cider. So that's fun. And then, yes, the small batch. Oh, this has been my absolute
Can I ask you before we go to small batch?
Of course, yeah.
So the fruit ciders, are those semi-sweet? Is that how you would, like on the scale of dryness to sweet?
I would say most of them fall in the semi-dry to semi-sweet. That's kind of our, sweet spot, if you will. Like we're not super sweet cider drinkers ourselves. And we do the, all the berries is on the sweet side of a semi-sweet. So kind of right on that line to where you could call it a sweet. It's much sweeter than we enjoy drinking, but, we being the cider makers, my family grew up drinking Kool-Aid. So they love that. That's, that's their jam. And, they also like it when I take our Loganberry cider and I add twice the Loganberries and I make a batch called the Special Reserve, Rick's Reserve. And that's Rick is my uncle. And it's just so sweet and filled with Loganberries and they love it. They go through kegs of it in their, possibly in their home. So anyways, but yes, I would say it falls kind of right in the middle of the spectrum. It's definitely not as sweet as some of the kind of national brands that hit that just that market, that niche of people who want a sweet cider. And, we always joke that they're working for the 18 to 20 year old, 21 year old crowd. But,
What about the alcohol by volume, the ABV for those guys?
They tend to be like the Logan is down at 6% because it's back sweetened only with apple juice.
Okay.
And then, Same with the peach raspberry. It's a little bit lower, like 6.2, because the peaches bring some sweetness there. And then with our others that we do a little bit of sugar at the end, like all the berries, it has a little bit of sugar, and then our tropical things. I do have to tell the story. So when I first started making cider, I was so principled, Rhea, and I was only going to use the fruit that we grew ourselves. Anything in my ciders, we were going to grow it. And so I felt like that gave me plenty of room to work with, because we grow so many things. Mm-hmm. And so that was what I did. Well, there was not an event that I went to or a day that I was pouring at the growler station up front that I didn't get asked for a pineapple cider. And it just eats your soul just a little bit when you're an authentic, you know, in my mind, a real cider maker. I only make cider with fruits we grow, nothing added. And I wasn't ever gonna, you know, put any crazy things in my cider unless we grew it. Cause that was kind of what being a farmer was to me. Mm-hmm. And there I was every day out on the front lines, people wanting a pineapple cider. And it was so devastating to me, because I'm like, I don't think you understand. We're farmers. Right. We grow things, and we're going to put the things we grow in our cider, and that's all. And they were like, yeah, but pineapple. And so one year, kind of as a joke, in all honesty, we had a cider festival here on the farm, and we invited, you know, like 12 other cideries to come, and everybody was going to pour three ciders. And it was in the fall as part of our harvest fest. And so as part of that, we did a people's choice vote where, you know, everybody got to drop their little token into the cup for their favorite cider. Mm-hmm. And I am not exaggerating when I say that 90% of the votes, and we're talking, this would have been like 30 plus different ciders present, because 12 cider makers, three ciders each, 90% of the votes went for my joke of a pineapple cider.
Wow.
Because it was, and I had pureed pineapples. I chopped them and I pureed them. So it was no small task. It was a real pain in the butt. Mm-hmm. And then to get that filtered out, or strained out rather, of the cider. Oh my gosh, it was so much work. But all these people just went bananas, and they were like, oh, I hope you bottle that. And I was like, oh my God, people don't even care. They just don't care. And it was something I probably, you know, so that would have been in October that we had that festival. I think I sat with that all winter, and I was like, what am I going to do about this? Like, that's possibly how you make enough money to buy equipment, making ciders like that. And still I have a commitment to using, you know, whole fruits and whole foods and whole, you know, fresh as can be, local as can be. But sometimes our freezer is empty of berries, and we have to think, like, how are we going to make modern ciders that people want to buy? And so then we started doing like a guava grapefruit and a pineapple coconut, like a pina colada. Mm-hmm. And you know what? What I've convinced myself, we'll say that, is that it's somebody's responsibility to grow the pie of cider, to grow the market share, right? And we can't all sit back and say, I'm only making dry, sophisticated, high tannin, English cider. You know what I mean? We can't all do that, or the pie doesn't get bigger. And I think we all agree within the cider industry that the pie could be bigger. Mm-hmm. There could be more cider drinkers. We could have a bigger market share of alcohol consumption. Mm-hmm. And we should, by all means, like, it's in all of our best interest to do that, to grow the market. Mm-hmm. And so this is me doing my part to grow the market share. It's not the part that I'm most passionate about. I mean, I feel great when we come up with a really interesting and still balanced flavor that people want to buy, and they just go bonkers over it. And, you know, like the groupies that we have over our pina colada cider, it's uncanny.
Is like is that a certain age range of people that you find going for the pina colada and some of these?
It sure is. I could tell you a story. I had this account that was buying a ton of kegs of pina colada cider, and he had reached out and said, "Hey, can you stop by sometime? I'd love to talk to you about doing an event." And I was like, "Okay." And my husband had pulled the data, and he was like, "Wow, this guy's going through like 2 half barrels a week of this pina colada, which is crazy to
That's
me." He's this, you know, big tap room. And so I stopped by there, and he says, "Oh, I'm so glad you're here right now. So this entire table has a glass of pina colada." Like maybe 8 women, they say, "We love your cider. Where are you located?" And I said, "Well, we're down in Woodburn." Jervis Woodburn, it's, you know, all these little farm towns. Mm-hmm. And, I said, "We're down in Woodburn and on a farm." And they said, "Oh, Woodburn, where the outlet malls are." And that's always my cringy thing, right? Like, yes, the outlet malls. It also has a vibrant farming community, you know? And so, but they're like, "Where the outlet malls are." And I said, "Yeah." And they said, "Well, the Crocs store at the outlet has a huge sale like every other month. So we always go down for the Crocs sale." And they're all wearing their Crocs. They're like high heeled Crocs. And I'm like, "I didn't even know
that was a thing. Is that a thing? High heel Crocs? Really? This is the first I've heard about it."
Yes, it is. They were, I guess they're wedges. They're wedges. Okay. I shouldn't throw the fashion conscious among us into a tizzy over that. They're wedges. Okay. And I just, in my mind right then, I was like, this is the demographic of pina colada cider, which is brilliant.
Yeah.
They're going to drink something. It might as well be cider. Because then one day they will say, "Hey, I'm going to try a French bittersweet cider." And then they're going to fall in love with that. And then one day they'll branch out into an English cider and they'll become the cider maker that we dream of them becoming.
That's true. That is true. Well, it's good to keep dreaming. And there's a cider for every age out there. You know, it used to say for every palate, but I think it's for every age at this point. Because it does change over time. So let's dig into your small batch cider. And what do you mean by small batch in terms of quantity? Is these 5-gallon carboys or something else?
There are a few that are 5-gallon carboys, but more often it tends to be somewhere between 100 and 300 gallons.
Mm-hmm.
And these are single varietals. You know, I'll tie this back to one of my favorite cider bars or cider locales in the Portland area is a bar seems too diminishing. It's a hangout. It's a local spot. It's the Cider Makers Cider Bar. It's called The Place. Have you been there?
No, I
haven't.
Know
you went. It used to be Bushwhackers.
Oh, okay.
In Portland.
Bushwhackers. Okay,
so you would have gone to Bushwhackers.
Right.
Well, then, you know, Bushwhackers went under and The Place became The Place for cider drinkers. And he is the most brilliantly curated cider list and just tons of bottles from all over the world. He imports, well, he doesn't import, but he buys imported ciders, Spanish and French and English and some New Zealand. I mean, just like an amazing selection, all that you can imagine, tons from the East Coast. And it's just like the greatest place. And he has maybe like 4 ciders on draft. And why was I saying that?
We're talking about small batch. Your small batches.
Oh, small batch. So he says to me on more than one occasion, David is the proprietor, and he says that he hates single varietal ciders because the whole reason there are different apples is so that you can blend them. And I took that as a personal challenge to make only small batch single varietal ciders to knock his socks off.
Right.
So that's been the story of my last 2 years is making single varietal ciders and just trying to like make him eat his words with each batch. And he posted a picture recently and sent it to me and is his reader board of what was on tap in his at the place at that moment was four different single varietal ciders. And he goes, this is my worst nightmare. But of course, they wouldn't be up there if you didn't love them. Right. Because he curates so well, mm-hmm. that, you know, he chooses them. He doesn't get stuck with anything. He's not mm-hmm. limited to distributors. He gets a lot from mm-hmm. self-distributed small cideries and very like startup and craft cideries. So it is my great joy to make a lot of single varietal ciders. I do blends as well in this, mm-hmm. but my flavor of the moment is taking one apple at a time. And I think that we've become better cider makers for mm-hmm. doing that, mm-hmm. because when you're left with nothing but an apple, mm-hmm. then you have to think about like, how do I bring this out? Does this want time in oak? Does this want time in stainless? Does it want to sit mm-hmm. in the fridge for a long time? Does it want this yeast or that yeast? Mm-hmm. And so it's been an adventure of cider making to really deep dive into these mm-hmm. apples, these single varietals. And other than my Macintosh, which is from Montana, all the rest are from right around here. You know, we're getting them either on our farms, things mm-hmm. we've planted. Mm-hmm. And I did just plant 4 acres of Macintosh that I got. Wow. The Steinwood is from Ryle in Montana. And I am so excited about that. It'll be a couple years before I'm harvesting off of that field. But
so why the Macintosh from Montana? What is that about? That would be unique
yes.
to that.
I'll tell you. So I love Macintosh. I love the Macintosh ciders that I've had on the East Coast. You know, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Stormalong's done one that I've had. Mm-hmm. And one of my favorite East Coast ciders is Artifact. And I love their Macintosh. Mm-hmm. And so, like, it is iconic to me, that Macintosh aromatic and the flavor, just the whole experience of a Macintosh, like takes me back to my youth. We mm-hmm. always grew them, but then they went out of fashion and mm-hmm. people didn't grow them on the West Coast anymore. Mm-hmm. So there are a few cideries in Missoula, Montana that have been making these Macintosh ciders the last few years, and I hope I get these years right. In 2018, the Portland International Cider Cup was won by Lee from Montana Cider Works, mm-hmm. and it was her Macintosh, and it was amazing. I was judging that year, and I tasted that cider, and I put the glass down and I said, this is the winning cider. You know, and you're tasting mm-hmm. cider after cider mm-hmm. after cider. You know from judging mm-hmm. like just like all day, it's a grueling effort to judge so many different ciders and to keep your palate fresh and to keep your wits about you. Mm-hmm. And so here I am, I'm, you know, several hours deep into this cider judging, and I taste that cider, Macintosh cider from Lee. And I was mm-hmm. like, this is it. This cider is so incredible, balanced and flavorful and interesting and legit. Just, mm-hmm. it just like knocked my socks off. And she won the cup with that cider. It was her Darby Pub cider, which is not 100% Mac, but I think it's mostly Mac, mm-hmm. if not all. And then 2 years later, again, I know I screwed up the years. I think she might've been 17. And then in 2019, was the year that Western Cider, also from Missoula, won the cup with their Macintosh cider. And damn, it is so good. Just amazing. And if you haven't had it, then you should have it. And so when Ryle would be pressing for me, Ryle, of course, being from Missoula or mm-hmm. nearby, mm-hmm. I would, you know, I want to know, like, what is mm-hmm. it that's making these ciders so incredible? And mm-hmm. I, you know, was picking his brain on that. And he said, you know, I could get you some of that juice. Wow. Well, Rhea, mm-hmm. that's what we did. Uh-huh. We got some of that juice and we got some of that cyanwood. And, you know, he says, Rao mentioned that the way the trees are grown there, you know, this old rootstock, mm-hmm. difficult conditions, mm-hmm. tough winters, mm-hmm. pathetic soil. Well, I don't know if it's pathetic, but it's not easy soil. It's mm-hmm. not the fertile grounds of the Willamette Valley. Mm-hmm. It's super windy. It's difficult.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Some real conditions out there. And he said that that makes those Macintosh what they are. And I believe it. And I hope that I don't have an aha moment 4 years after I planted this 4 acres of Macintosh where I'm like, huh, I guess this really isn't the right conditions to grow these apples.
Interesting. I mean, because I've heard of cider makers pulling out Macintosh to put in, you know, the quote unquote cider apples. So it's unusual that you're doing this. Is that also because you could also use it for the eating market too?
No, in fact, my uncle who manages our culinary orchards said, "What are you doing? That's the craziest thing ever. I tore out all my Macintosh 2 years ago."
Wow.
And he said, "Nobody wants to eat a Macintosh. Nobody likes Macintosh juice." And I was like, "Huh. Well, you're wrong."
Just wait.
Anyways,
and
you know, because I'm so emphatically stubborn, I can get away with that.
If I
doubted myself at all, then it would probably never work.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you shouldn't, because I could speak volumes on Macintosh too, and I have made that many ciders out of Mac, and it's really delightful. And this is where I love always quoting Jerome DuPont, because he said, "Stop looking outside of your borders, use what you have locally and see what you take it." And people don't consider a Mac that way, but you know, going dry with the Mac and the fruitiness and the sparkle to it, it really comes through. So I know that you're going to have a Mac in the Northwest Cider Club box for the fall of 2021 here. And
yes,
can you tell us a little bit more about that particular cider?
Yes, I can. I sent you a sample of the one from this last year, the 2020 batch of Macintosh, which we ferment cold and slow, like the coldest. We do pitch at commercial yeast, but it's a super cold end of the spectrum for that yeast. We held back just a little bit of Macintosh juice to back sweeten with after the fermentation. So we had frozen some juice and put it away and pulled that out so that it would be 100% Macintosh.
All the Macintoshes, you know, are really smiling right now out there in the orchard. Save us.
I know. You know, it's like how people, there's always this, this intrigue of the great American novel. Well, I consider Macintosh the great American apple.
Though it is from Canada.
Oh, stop it. That's America. That's
America. North America. North America. That was Christine Walter of Bauman's Cider, based in Oregon. You'll find links to Bauman's and more at the show notes to this here episode 296 at ciderchat.com. This here podcast is listener supported. So if you have followed this closely to this amazing conversation with Christine Walter and so many other fine guest on Cider Chat, please do consider becoming a patron today. You could go to the Cider Chat Patreon page or just hit the donate button at ciderchat.com. And with that, I leave you here. This is Rhea Windcaller signing off for now. Looking forward to seeing you in Ciderville.
We like cider, we like palms, we love orchards and having fun. There is a reason,
there is a reason why we do it like this.
Oh yes, there is.
There is a reason why we do it like this.
Oh yes, there is.
There is a reason why we drink it like this.
Oh yes, there is. There is a reason.
We like walking through the orchards, dancing in the streets, smelling all the blossoms, kicking up our feet. We like cider, we like palms, we like orchards, having some fun.
There is a reason.
There is a reason why we do it like this. Oh yes, there is.
There is a reason why we do it like this.
Oh yes, there is.
There is a reason why we drink it like this.
Oh yes, there is.
There is a reason.
We like walking through the orchards, dancing in the streets, smelling all the blossoms, kicking up our feet. Oh yeah.
We like cider.
Oh yes, we do.
We like palms.
Oh yes, we do.
We love orchards,
having some fun.
There is a reason. There is a reason why we do it like this.
Ba-da-da-dum.
There is a reason why we do it like this.
Ba-da-da-dum.
There is a reason why we drink it like this.
Ba-da-da-dum. Ba-da-da-dum. We like walking down the orchards, dancing in the streets, smelling all the blossoms, kicking up our feet, oh yeah.
We like cider,
ba-da-da-dum.
We like palms,
oh yes we do.
We like orchards, having some fun.
Yeehaw!